Hello and welcome. It's been a week of political slings thrown and arrows shot in the countdown to the French elections. President Macron took aim not just what he calls far-right extremists, but he labelled left-wing alliance immigrationist, suggesting that they won't control borders. And there are reports too of a split within his own camp. Once loyal Macronists are talking of a lack of a plan in the middle of this electoral tempest.
The solution I've taken is the heaviest, the most serious, but it's the most responsible, the least bad. The people had to be able to decide, and I have confidence.
It's been a week that's seen an early hours meet and greet for President Putin arriving in Pyongyang for the first time in 24 years, and a red carpet welcome at 3 a.m. from North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Friends indeed for friends in need, both facing sanctions and wanting each other's military know-how or arms and ammunition. A show of unity and unity designed to worry the West in a week where NATO looks set to appoint Mark Rutte as its new Secretary General.
It is, of course, an incredibly interesting position. It starts in 3 months. There is a fantastic Secretary General at the moment. But let me not give the impression that I am going to do something different from Jens Stoltenberg.
And it's been a week that's seen the plot thicken in the controversy surrounding one of Netflix's biggest ever shows, Baby Reindeer. The series about a stalker and the stalked is described as a true story, but the woman claiming to be the inspiration for the main character is suing for $170 million, calling the series the biggest lie in TV history. Film producers describing the debate as a seminal moment for the industry. We'll discuss how true a true story has to be.
Really manly hands, haven't you? Chiseled jawline. Should we run away together?
She comes to my work, my house. She sends me emails, like, all the time.
Are any threatening towards you?
You're a comedian?
Sort of.
It's not going well.
So is that a question?
Somebody hurt you, didn't they? Who was it?
Martha, can you let go of my...
Ladies and gentlemen, this is my stalker. Say hello to Martha.
Don't you say that to me! Apologise to me right now!
Can't take my mum anywhere.
You're shy.
Welcome to The World This Week. And joining us from the International Press Corps, we have Naomi Bizerbe, Wall Street Journal reporter covering French politics, French Hello. Policy. Hey, Naomi, thank you for being with us. We also have with us Agnès Poirier, Paris-based author, journalist, Express newspaper in London at the moment. Hey, Agnès, welcome.
Thank you.
And Baga Marie. Back with us again, seasoned journalist, independent, Paris-based a reporter, former editor of the New York Times Style magazine, editor of the International Herald Tribune business desk in Paris. I could go on. Great to have you back on the programme, Anne. And let's cross to Italy too. We have Seema Gupta, Rome correspondent for us here at France 24. Hey, Seema, good to see you. And let's get on
great
with...
Great to be on the show.
Great to see you, Seema. Let's get on with the programme tonight and we'll get straight into it because Tuesday this week was technically day two of the French election campaign trail, but technically day nine in reality since the trigger shot was fired by the president in his shock announcement. And it was a day that President Macron chose to make a rallying speech off the Brittany coast on the island of Saint in an attempt to summon the spirit of resistance. It was 84 years to the day that Charles de Gaulle made his rallying radio appeal from London to the French against the Nazi forces. Back then, the entire male population of the island were said to have set sail for the UK to join the resistance and were awarded, as an island, the Order of Liberation. Optics matter right now. President Macron taking aim at the far-right national rally, calling them extremists and a danger to society. No new rhetoric there. But in words he's never used publicly before, lambasting the left-wing alliance. The programme of the new Popular Front, he said, was totally immigrationist and said it would have no control over migration.
On the evening of the 9th of June, Macronism died. It no longer exists. In reality, today, Emmanuel Macron has lost all strength and all legitimacy to be the dam against the national rally. And so only we on the left can be the dam that French democracy so badly needs.
So, incoming flak coming from Raphael Glucksmann from the Socialist and left, New Left Alliance, the Parisian press suggesting a divorce in Macron's camp between him and some of his once loyal Macronists over fears of what's being perceived as a lack of a plan to beat the far right. This is how it looks, with many of his party campaign posters, videos not using his image, including his own prime minister, the campaign bid for Gabriel Attal. In an interview, the president criticised those within his camp who said held a spirit of defeat. Well, let's go first to Noémie. How would you sum up this week?
Well, I think that clearly Macron has caught everybody off guard with this decision to dissolve the National Assembly, and including his own lawmakers. And they feel unprepared. And they are, quite frankly, many of them are angry at Macron for taking this decision and putting them in this spot where they feel they're heading for disaster because they're squeezed. They feel squeezed between the right and the left, and they feel that Macron has become more of a liability than anything else. So I think that it's going to be a very interesting campaign to follow.
Last week kind of felt in the midst of the tempest as the campaigns were being organised. Alliances attempted on the right and failed. And alliances and a marriage of convenience we're seeing on the left. How's this week seemed in terms of the daily events, the slings and the arrows that have been fired from party to party?
So I think that clearly the fact that the left came so quickly together was a big surprise for Macron and definitely not something he was banking on. And the fact that there are, even if we can feel that tension or building up a bit, they are all controlling themselves, and I think that they will keep it together until the elections. On the right side, it's been such a disastrous show for Les Républicains. What Ciotti will really be able to achieve and how many votes he'll be able to bring to Marine Le Pen remains very unclear at this point. But clearly, they are going to struggle. I mean, the Conservatives are going to struggle in this election. And Macron could benefit a bit from that, but it remains to be seen.
And yes, Noémie mentioned Éric Ciotti. And I want to talk about the broader sense of how the party is doing. But I do want to focus in on this for a minute. So you have the Conservatives, the Republicans Party, where, you know, you've seen an optics this week of having Jordan Bardella on the far right going to a big French business meeting with Éric Ciotti, the Republicans, and real split within his party about whether he should be there at all right now. What do you read into what's going on?
Well, I mean, Éric Ciotti, the leader of the Gaullist party, who must be turning in his grave, decided his own eviction. Because remember, you know, he announced, I'm going to enter an alliance with, he said, a few dozen, and in effect, I think there are 62 of his MPs going in alliance with the hard right, with Le Pen. But the rest of the party actually behaved quite bravely. I mean, straight away they said, this is impossible, this is not who we are. They went, when he barricaded himself in the party's HQ, they went to find the spare key, and some of them rolled their sleeves.
Possibly the image of the week, wasn't it?
Yeah,
last
it
week
was.
When you saw the door for 24 hours on French live TV. It was insane.
It was insane, and much laughed about in Britain, where you know, where I'm based and where politics is starting to feel slightly calmer after 8 years of utter shambles. So we're just taking the relay here. So, well, on the right, it's quite obvious that the Gaullist party has imploded. So it's now split into two. So one is clearly with Marine Le Pen, and the others will have, you know, some of them will be endorsed. It depends on the constituency by the Republican Front, the Front Républicain, or also called Ensemble pour la République. There are so many words. And they are clearly putting themselves in the sort of big centre. But they don't like Macron very much. I mean, it's more a marriage of convenience, but it's absolutely necessary. Now, on the left, they were very quick to unite, that's for sure, and it must have been a surprise for the president. On the other hand, it's not a marriage of convenience, it's a forced marriage. And when Raphael Glucksmann says that Macronism died on the 18th of June. Well, socialism, the French way, also died when they entered an alliance with their nemesis. I mean, voters see this and don't buy it, basically. You know, former enemies suddenly, you know, controlling themselves or trying to, and we know they are going to be at each other's throat in, you know, after the election. So and many voters, actually, the hashtag on French Twitter, neither fascist nor fascist, is gaining traction. A lot of people say, I cannot, if faced at the second round with the National Front, or rather National Rally, the hard right, I cannot bring myself to vote for an xenophobic party, but I cannot either bring myself to vote for pro-Hamas, anti-Semitic, Putin lover party. So, you know, there might be quite a lot of people abstaining on the second round. We're not there yet, though. We should come straight on the first round.
They're kind of between a rock and a hard place for more centrist voters. And you've had a very interesting few weeks because you've kind of had an outside-in perspective. You've been to the States, and one thing, you've been talking to those in the US, Americans, about how they see the French elections and the state of French politics.
Yeah. The question I got the most often during my month in the States was, should we be worried about France? Is France now in the same category as Hungary, as Poland was before it sort of woke up and put Tusk back in power? Should we be worried about France? And my initial reaction, based on 33 years here and seeing how Macronisme grew up as a reaction to and as a bulwark against the National Front, as it was called then, my first reaction was, not yet. Because the way these things have shaken out ever since Jean-Marie Le Pen made it through to the second round in the year escapes me now, in the
2002.
Thank you very much. Ever since that happened, and in the second round, France rose up and said, no, can't have that. Happened with Macron the first time around. It happened with Macron the second time around. The first vote is the vote for the heart, a protest vote, if you like, in many cases. And the second vote is the head. We can't know. We may have said we're unhappy with the current state of affairs, but we really can't go that far right with this country. And I think I may have spoken too soon. Now that I've come back to France and started talking to people and seen some of the things that have happened this week, which Noémie pointed out, the left coming together so quickly, what you've pointed out, and yes, the voters saying, I'm facing a terrible choice. The only choice I may have is not to vote. I don't think either of those things was in Macron's calculations when he rolled the dice and said, And you know, he said, I don't know exactly where he said it first, but he said, I'd rather give Marine Le Pen's party the keys to Matignon in 2024 than the keys to the Élysée in 2027. Clearly, he was
Prime Minister's office rather than to the presidency.
Right. Clearly, he was gambling and he was asking the French to call the bluff that they put forward during the European elections. Something tells me that there's a frantic scrambling going on somewhere in his party to say, this was an enormous miscalculation. What are we going to do now? So I agree with Noémie. It's going to be very, very interesting to see how this plays out.
It's also worth just stepping elsewhere to Italy and to you, Seema, because Anne talked about the moment of the centre saying it will never happen, going back to 2002 and looking at events to say, you know, the centre will hold. I've covered Italian elections. There have been many of them in the past where the centre, people like Matteo Renzi of the past, said, you know, stick with us, with socialism. And we've seen a hard right party. It used to be called far right. Now they're called the hard right with Giorgia Meloni. How do you see this looking from Rome?
Well, looking from Rome, what I see happening in France reminds me of the election in 2022, when we saw this right-wing coalition government, when we saw Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy party come up tops with the largest number of votes, and then, of course, her coalition. Now, it's very similar in a way, because back then, her party was untested. It was a fresh face. Yes, they've had Matteo Renzi. They've had dealings with the centre-left, with Enrico Letta. The Italians were saying, well, we've seen those. Things didn't improve so dramatically for us. Well, this is a fresh new start. Why don't we give her a try? And perhaps a similar thing may be happening in France, where I've been reading about French voters saying, we're frustrated with politics as usual. Why don't don't we give these people a try? In the case of Meloni, of course, it was also helpful for her that she was in the only party in opposition when we had a technocrat government led by Prime Minister Mario Draghi. And so that was during the COVID years. So if there were voters frustrated over COVID policy, they would definitely be choosing her. And so we suddenly saw her come up on top. Now, at the same time, back then as well, in 2022, there was all this concern about Giorgia Meloni and the far right coming into power. What was this going to mean in terms of the situation in Europe? But what we've seen so far is a very pro-European Meloni, if you like. At least that's the one Meloni that we've seen on the European stage, especially when it comes to Ukraine. She steadfastly stood on the side of the Ukrainians. But when it comes to perhaps cultural issues, she seems to be taking her more hard right stance when it comes to anti-LGBT Q rights or even abortion rights.
I'm also struck, Seema, by the similarity in how the press talk about the National Rally leader, Jordan Bardella, talk of Bardellamania, about how he's smart, he speaks well, he's ultra-presentable, but as the BBC article this week described, quote, nicely wrapped but a mystery. And I've had guests on the programme recently talking in exactly the same way about Giorgia Meloni before the European election, saying that she remains a mystery.
Yes, and a fresh face as well. I mean, if you compare the two leaders and their backgrounds, Bardella, he is someone who grew up in a disadvantaged neighbourhood in France. Giorgia Meloni comes from the Roman neighbourhood of Garbatella, working class neighbourhood. Both of them brought up by single mothers as well. And in terms of educational qualifications, not that same high level of educational qualifications as compared to other leaders in the past. So presenting themselves as one with the people, Giorgia Meloni speaking in Roman dialect at times and in a very Roman way, like she's really one with the people. So perhaps both of them presenting a fresh face and in that sense, fresh ideas. But of course, a very different political system here in Italy. We have a president, but the president is largely ceremonial as compared to the role of Macron. Prime Minister Meloni having more powers perhaps than a president in Italy. At the same time, though, these comparisons between Bardella and Meloni, different age groups, I have to say, but really very similar backgrounds, similar fresh face and fresh appeal, really is what we're seeing with these two leaders.
Thank you, Seema. One thing that was just worth mentioning to Noemi, should we be careful of easier similarities between a Brothers of Italy party coming in, which have been pro-Ukraine. They've been less rocking the boat in terms of Europe. And the National Rally, Jordan Bardella this week talking about wanting to cut the budget that goes into Europe. And also quite a different relationship with Vladimir Putin between Marine Le Pen and the Russians.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's tempting to compare Meloni and with Bardella or Marine Le Pen, but they are aligned to some extent on domestic issues. Clearly, the focus is like immigration, crime, but National Rally's position on international issues is very different. She is firmly anti-European. Years ago, she wanted to leave the Europe. She wanted France to leave the European Union. She has very close ties with Russia. We know that Russia helped finance some of her campaigns. And on NATO, they've said repeatedly that they wanted to leave the military command. And clearly, if she was elected, it would represent a dramatic shift in France's relationship with the West, with the US, and the consequences would be very different from what we're seeing in Italy now.
A brief word, Agnes, on the use of the words immigrationist this week. This is something that's been labelled as Emmanuel Macron from the far right before, not controlling the borders, but the stigma that's attached with the label and that he's using now on the left. What do you make of that?
Well, he's throwing his grenade, another one.
The fear factor.
Well, he wants to take part in the sort of recomposition, but before recomposition, there's decomposition, and this is what's happening. I mean, you know, he dissolved parliament, but it feels as if the whole country is dissolving in front of our eyes. So it is very strange that he should use that word. That's not him or his politics. He's obviously trying to achieve something. I don't know what exactly. Probably he wants to show, but it doesn't even have to do that because many voters can see that the hard left and the hard right are very dangerous for the country for different reasons. Mm. And that this alliance is not what the Front Républicain, Republican Front, should be like.
OK, we're talking about danger to the country, perhaps to the West in some many eyes. Let's take you to Pyongyang Airport, 3 a.m. Wednesday. President Putin lands in North Korea for the first time in 24 years. On the tarmac for the meet and greet was the country's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un. Two poker-faced leaders of prior states let down their guard, a handshake, hugs and smiles all round. And from early morning red carpets and red roses, so begins the rare state visit. A mutual defence pact signed between military inspections, a tea party, a gala concert, even a coffee in cars show moment of deep friendship with President Putin, gifting his host a Russian-made limo. Moscow wants ammunition. Well, here they are in their limo, BFFs. Moscow wants ammunition to continue its occupation of Ukraine. Pyongyang wants money and secrets for missiles, rocket technology too. And President Putin didn't rule out sending arms to North Korea.
Comprehensive partnership agreement signed today provides, among other things, for mutual assistance in the event of aggression against one of the participants in this document. In this regard, the Russian Federation does not rule out the development of military technical cooperation with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in accordance with the document signed today.
I have no doubt that this powerful treaty signed between our two countries will be very constructive, prospective, peace-loving and defensive, aimed at promoting and defending the fundamental interests of the two peoples of our countries.
A day later, news came through in Brussels. A new leader is poised to take over as NATO Secretary General. It is the former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte who secured the backing of each member state. The only other credible competitor, Romania's President Klaus Iohannis, backed out. Teflon Mark was his nickname in The Hague. One biographer says the 57-year-old cycling fanatic has a trademark known as meveren. It means bouncing and stretching along in Dutch with whoever he needs to govern, to work with. Possibly useful in this next job. Agnes, let's first hear from Mark Rutte.
It is, of course, an incredibly interesting position. It starts in 3 months. There is a fantastic Secretary General at the moment. But let me not give the impression that I am going to do something different from Jens Stoltenberg.
Agnes, first of all, let's look at Putin, the visit, and how much of a threat you think this new deal is, and how much was part of unity, the optics of the moment.
Well, it's for us all, it's very worrying because it's just not an arm deal. You know, it's not just, give me a few munitions and I'll give you some satellites or at least some expertise on satellites and other things. It feels like a new alliance, a new realignment. Of course, you know, Vladimir Putin really needs, he ramps up production of arms, he really needs North Korea. It's the first time he goes, I think, in 20 years. They met, Kim went to Russia a few months ago. So it's certainly good for North Korean diplomacy because suddenly they have quite a lot of friends. They have China, they have Russia. Kim can actually play the two against each other, Russia and China. And for Russia, it's actually a way to really make the situation complicated for America and Asia and also at the UN, because they did support sanctions against North Korea originally. And recently they said, well, no, they've vetoed it. So they are making the situation pretty difficult. Now, in the long term, I think Russia has far more interest in having a good relationship with South Korea rather than North Korea. I mean, it's a great trading partner, and South Korea is also a great arms producer. So it might just be, you know, a question of a few years, but how long will the Ukraine war last? So it does, you know, it does complicate the situation. It's also, I think, worrying because there's nuclear expertise as well. I mean, Russia might not be as mad as sharing a very important, you know, expertise on it. But Kim will insist on at least some expertise on nuclear.
You've just got into that, the difficulty of more than a triangle now, just the political, difficult, complicated geopolitics. South Korea, the Russians recently talk of, you know, of those who are unfriendly towards the regime as they see it, the best relationship is with the South Koreans. They haven't sent arms to Ukraine. And there's been a warning this week from Vladimir Putin, despite this meeting with the North Koreans, not to send arms, and saying he's happy with that situation. So it's a balancing act. And Anne, on top of that, these two are meeting, talking about how their relationship is, quote, a firm friendship. But he didn't say unbreakable, like Vladimir Putin used with the Chinese. And I think that tells us about, at the top of the triangle here, is Beijing.
That's absolutely true. China is the unindicted co-conspirator in all of this. And it's actually not in China's interest to see this relationship go much farther, because China is actually a competitor to North Korea when it comes to supplying munitions and technology to Russia. In fact, some commentators have pointed out that China hasn't sent weapons, but it's sent chips and technology that have actually given Russia an edge in Ukraine at certain key moments of the war. Mm-hmm. So China's not going to be delighted to see Russia dancing with another partner. And China also has been in the past quite skeptical and quite reticent to form pacts like NATO. I mean, if you want to make a Chinese diplomat nervous, start talking about the alignment of evil, which is the updated version of the axis of evil. And it includes North Korea, Russia, China, and also Iran. Mm-hmm. China doesn't really want to be in the playground with all of them. China wants to keep its options open. So this bromance that's going on, that went on in Pyongyang in the middle of the night and ended with a car, it's not something that is going to be welcomed in Beijing. And in fact, it might lead to an escalation of some other kinds of approaches by China, or more likely a withdrawal by China from certain entreaties by Russia or North Korea or Iran to get on board and be part of our anti-NATO. So I do agree that it was not just an arms deal. On the other hand, it was basically an arms deal. And then the other part of it was probably that Russia and North Korea don't have many friends in the world. And now they have each other. In fact, one of the commentators who appeared on this station during the week said, one of the things that this benefits Russia for, one of its North Korea, is that it does have now an opening to the world community, a small one, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But for Putin, it almost cements the fact that he has no other friends in the world community. This was the only place he could go.
Yeah, very good point on Beijing as well. In the midst of this, they're wanting to open up to foreign tourism. They've recently waived visa rights for certain European members, for Australia, for Thailand too. They've opened up panda diplomacy again. And they've been pressured by the West, as you say, not to allow that dual-use technology to be used in Russia. Seema, in Rome, also, we've had a situation not too long ago where many analysts were talking about the, quote, love letters being exchanged between Donald Trump back in 2017 with Kim Jong-un, this blossoming relationship there. And it seems to be that US dynamic. There's a big unknown ahead of the elections coming up later this year.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, at the same time, everyone's looking to see what's going to be happening in a few months' time when we have that US election and who's going to be the next president and how that is going to impact what's happening in Ukraine, how that's going to be impact what's happening as far as North Korea and South Korea is concerned. And I think also it's important to mention that perhaps this visit that Putin made to North Korea, while very important in terms of boosting his ammunitions that he needs with the invasion of Ukraine, he also went to Vietnam. And I think this was part of his show to say, look, I'm accepted, I can travel, I'm traveling to East Asia, and this is not just the domain of Western democracies, but I can make a presence felt there as well. Now, the visit to Vietnam obviously was a little bit shorter, but definitely I think that was part of his whole spiel there. It will be interesting to see what will happen in the US if indeed we see another round of President Trump, and in terms of his relationship with both Vladimir Putin as well as with Kim Jong-un. I mean, he said back then when they did meet in that summit in Singapore that it was important for him to be face-to-face with these strong leaders. Now, that's been Trump's stance throughout. It definitely changed the dynamic compared to what we see now with the Biden presidency in the US.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Seema, stay with us because I also want to bring in to you as well the developments this week from India, because over the weekend, news emerged from New Delhi, the Booker Prize-winning author Arundhati Roy will be tried for comments she made about Kashmir 14 years ago. The Lieutenant Governor of the city agreed to sanction her prosecution under anti-terror laws called the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. These are comments she made during a lecture at the Little Theatre Group in New Delhi back in 2010.
Kashmir has never been an integral part of India. However aggressively and however often you want to ask me that, even the Indian government has accepted it.
Now, at the time, Indian-administered Kashmir was in turmoil. Locals described the situation as a fierce uprising against India, and a number of protesters died. Now, her critics say those remarks amount to a call for Kashmiri secession. And at the time, she said this in defence of the comments. She said in the paper, some of the accused give me hate speeches of wanting India to break up. On the contrary, what I say comes from love, pride. It comes not from wanting people to be killed, raped, imprisoned, or having the fingernails pulled out in order to force them to say they are Indians. Pity the nation, she says, that has to silence its writers for speaking their minds. So why now? The prosecution was first proposed back in 2023, but went quiet. A coincidence that this happened in a month after a shock election result in which Narendra Modi needs to build a coalition for the first time after not getting a supermajority he talked of for a third term. Critics say it's a political move, the most high-profile case in a long line of people being punished for speaking out against his BJP party, and a way of showing relevance after losing so many parliamentary seats, claims denied by the government. Seema, can you talk us through some of the developments here and the reactions to it this week?
Well, I mean, I think essentially you have this situation of the BJP having a reduced majority in the parliament and wanting to show perhaps that they can still clamp down on dissent, that that's not going to have an impact in terms of what they want to do. But to target someone like Arundhati Roy, a Booker Prize winner, someone who is critically acclaimed globally and has a worldwide following, we'll have to see whether that's actually going to pan out for them or is going to backfire on the government. This kind of clamping down on free speech, India, supposed to be the largest democracy of the world, and yet we're seeing this situation where free speech is being curtailed by certain laws. Now, it's interesting to note, if you like, certain similarities, if you like, with Italy, you have Giorgia Meloni using the defamation law to clamp down on statements that have been made by journalists and writers. Or we've seen a case brought against Roberto Saviano, a prominent writer and journalist here in Italy. She's even come after against the lead singer of the band Placebo because he made certain statements about her party. So really, both countries, India and Italy, falling in terms of press freedom index ranking globally in the last few years.
Seema, just tell us about Arundhati, her work, politics, the way of life, how she is regarded.
Well, I mean, she wrote The God of Small Things back in 1997. The book won the Booker Prize and it really put her up there in the world stage. She was, celebrated around the world. And since then, most of her writing, though, has been largely a non-fiction. She's talked about the issue of Kashmir. She's also talked about the building of dams and the impact that has in terms of the environment in India, but also on communities that have to be displaced as a result of it. So she's written a large deal on those things, and she's participated in talks like that one that we saw all those years ago in that little theatre in Delhi. So those are the kinds of things that she's talked about more. And she's become an activist, if you like, supported by those who feel that India in some ways has had its freedom of speech and freedom of thought curtailed as being, when people make statements like that, they're immediately branded as being anti-nationalist. And that is really a concern for what's happening in India. The critics say she is against India, but those who support her say, well, she has the right to speak and open her mind. And it's important to note, I stress again, she has a worldwide following. She is supported by other liberals in other parts of the world, in the US and in the UK. They follow her writings, they follow her ideas. So it's a very high profile case. We'll have to see how far the prosecution actually goes ahead on this issue. They've said that they want to put that law on her, but we'll have to see how far it goes.
And yes, is this an interesting moment where, when there are those that speak out, perhaps against Beijing and China, you hear from Washington, you often hear from significant figures. We're not getting much of an international voice right now about this, are we?
Not yet, but I mean, Seema is really right to say that Arundhati Roy is an international figure, you know, famous, throughout the world and very vocal and known for this. And criticism should not be a matter for a prison sentence in a democracy. Because that's the thing with India, you know, regular elections, the largest democracy in the world, but we also see corruption, we also see the brutality of Modi's governments and the Hindu nationalism as well. So, do they want to just frighten her and therefore, voices of dissent, or do they want to go all the way to actually sentencing her? Then you can bet the whole world will be, outraged. So, and also it's the third time Modi is elected, but this time he doesn't have as big a majority as he used to. He has to enter a coalition. So it's his way to say, look, I'm still in control. So it's very symbolic, on his part, and also to attack such a prominent figure.
There's something I wanted to mention, and it has to do with the law under which she's being prosecuted. It's not a speech law. It's an anti-terrorist law. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's a playbook that has been run fairly successfully in countries like my own United States, the UK, and elsewhere, using an anti-terrorist law to crack down on civil liberties. Sadly, it has worked in the past. There have been plenty of instances to cite in the U.S. In this case, though, I think India may have put a foot wrong, because as we've seen this kind of prosecution unfold and we've seen the hollowness behind the wish to supposedly protect against terrorism, but really just to silence people we don't like, they might have overreached in this one. It'll be very interesting to see exactly how far this goes.
Well, it's interesting how it's being picked up. The Conversation newspaper this week talking about how this is, quote, business as usual for the Modi government. And the Human Rights Watch, quote, for the first few months of 2024, at least 134 instances of free speech violations, journalists, academics, YouTubers students among those affected. And we haven't heard recently from Arundhati Roy. She lives in Delhi, previously, as Seema said as well. She has spoke about many events. She said this, quote, in the past, "You can't be a writer in the city without commenting on the realities of life around you." She said, "I was once the darling of the establishment and after God of small things, but I first started talking about nuclear situation in India, and I then became an end of my time, almost like the cutting of a fairy tale princess out of a book." So that's the case of at the moment we're looking at Arundhati Roy. And as Seema said just a moment ago, we will see. At the moment, it's at the prosecution stage, and if there's a trial, we'll bring you that when it comes. Next to a story that's become a zeitgeist, and a lot of people, well, 85 million people around the world have seen the movie from Netflix, Baby Reindeer. And this week at the Monte Carlo TV Festival, it dominated much of the conversation for film producers. It's become a phenomenon in terms of revenue brought in as well. The controversy that surrounds it has been described by a senior executive at the festival as a seminal moment in TV history, affecting the whole industry. And the question it raises is, how true does a true story have to be? The show depicts the apparently real-life story of a fledgling comedian working as a barman who becomes a victim of relentless harassment from a convicted stalker. And though the names have been changed, it begins with the line, "This is a true story." And for the few that haven't seen it, here's a segment.
Got really manly hands, haven't you? Chiseled jawline. Should we run away together? So you're a comedian?
Sort of.
It's not going well.
So is that a question?
Somebody hurt you, didn't they? Who was it?
Martha, can you let go of my hand now, please? Martha, please let go!
Don't you dare!
Well, a woman called Fiona Harvey has come forward claiming the drama's alleged stalker, called Martha, in the show, is based on her, but protesting that she isn't a convicted stalker, and on that basis is suing Netflix for $170 million, a lawsuit that claims it is the biggest lie in TV history. Anne, let's start with you. What do you make of it?
Well, you started out talking about how 85 million people have seen this. I'll give you another big number. 283 billion. That is the market capitalization of Netflix on, I imagine, the New York Stock Exchange. So I don't think the NASDAQ goes that high. It is an enormous company with a lot of market clout, and that's a lot of shareholders' money at stake. So you really have to ask yourself, and here I'm bringing years of reporting on the law to this. How on earth was there not someone at Netflix to say, if you say it's a true story, you are leaving this production and everybody connected with it open to massive legal liability? All you really had to do was say, based on a true story, or this is a work of fiction and any resemblance to... There have been disclaimers like that out in, you know, this is a 70, 80 year trend in entertainment.
Well, in
why did Netflix feel as though they had to... Why? Marketing.
Well, at the end of the show, so it starts with, this is a true story, nothing more. At the end, feet credits, we see it says, this is based on a true story. Some of the scenes' names have been changed for necessary purposes. Now, is that a caveat that justifies and allows for a defense of Netflix or not?
It absolutely does. So why did they have to over-egg the pudding, to use a good British expression, and put this is a true story at the
beginning?
At the top. That's all anybody sees. It's a little bit like what we used to get in the newspaper business. Oh, you made the mistake on page one, but the correction's on page 85. Okay? There were ways to avoid this. I mean, where is the governance in this enormous company that has zillions of eyeballs on it every day and night?
Well,
to protect them from this.
And it's worth just raising. So Netflix's other point is they haven't said at any point who the alleged stalker is. Martha in the show, Fiona Harvey, has come forward on her own volition, done an interview, said, it is me. I am not convicted. Now, it's notable that she isn't suing on the basis that she was stalking, sending 41,000 messages or 350 no. hours of voicemail messages. It is on the line that I wasn't convicted. And yes, when you look at this case, do you think they've got some wiggle room here?
I'm not a lawyer, so I have no idea. But, you know, it looks as if they thought, you know, it was a small Scottish TV series. They never thought it would become a sort of global success. And here you are. You know, if it had remained a little Scottish story, watched by Britain, basically, then perhaps, you know, we wouldn't be talking about it today. And it's the best, you know, publicity. I mean, if it was a publicity stunt, you know, it would work the same way. I mean, also for her, the real character, nobody knew about her, apart from probably, you know, the family of that guy who wrote the story. And now she's a name. She's perhaps a brand, and she might be commissioned her own version. So you know, you don't know where to put the finger where. You only have now. I'm going to watch the series. You see, so it works.
Naomi, have you seen it, and would you watch it, given what we've just been discussing and this phenomenon?
I have not seen it, but I agree with Anna. It's incredible to think, like, why wouldn't it just say it's based on a true story? Because, frankly, for me, it wouldn't really make a world of difference. Like, whether they say it's based on a true story or on a true story, I'm not sure I'd even pay attention. If the show is good, I'd watch it. Yeah. Or maybe they just assume that the woman whose story is being told may not be too proud to come forward and say it's her. Mm. But clearly, when you see the kind of money the show is making, it creates some incentives.
Well, Netflix put it down to the algorithm. They say it's not down to the controversy. But thank you all. This will linger. This story will grow and grow, no doubt. Anne Bagger-Marie, Agnès Poirier, Naomi Bizerb, and Sima Gupta in Rome, thank you all. See you in 7 days' time. We'll be back. French election weekend for the world next week.